You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We're back with Radio EcoShock, and we've got a little bit more from that speech from Jeff Tumlin from the Gaining Ground Conference. He's the San Francisco planner who tells us that cars are making us fat, sick, and dead. Let's give it a listen.
The lower density community that we live in, the more driving that we do, the fatter that it makes us, the more unhealthy that it makes us. And that the social costs of all of this are astronomical. In San Francisco, the public health department has been keeping track just of the actual hospitalization and healthcare costs of pedestrian fatalities. It totaled $75 million over the course of 5 years, just dealing with cleaning up, the physical cleanup of pedestrian-related crashes in one city in 5 years, during a period of time when the transportation department had very, very little money to spend on pedestrian safety efforts. Instead, we're spending $75 million public money in the public health hospital in cleaning up after the fact. So, what next? Well, the reason for all of this is not because the market has demanded that we live in auto-dependent communities, but the fact that our laws require it. In nearly every city that I work, this one is a very unusual exception. It is illegal to create the kind of walkable communities that we know the market is demanding and that Hank has told us in the United Kingdom the market is absolutely demanding. And all of this in spite of the fact that every planning document that I ever read has all the good words in it. It's, you know, mixed-use neighborhoods and density near transit, reducing vehicle miles traveled, reduce CO2, promote walking and biking, blah, 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 motherhood and apple pie. And yet, when we go into the actual law, into the funding formulas, into the street design standards, into the nuts and bolts of the zoning code, this is what results. This is a walkable community because you've got a mix of uses up there, and there's a pedestrian and a crosswalk. So we've met the goals of our general plan in delivering what we've required. And so we wonder, however, if perhaps there is a bit of a mixed message. So, what's the solution? Well, as our previous speakers have already mentioned, in fact, all of them, there's a powerful relationship between density and the rates of driving. And the sweet spot that occurs in our old streetcar neighborhoods, in townhouses, in the places where that still accommodate the car and yet don't require a car for all trips. You don't need the density of Manhattan in order to have a walkable, healthy, sustainable community. Another thing that we've learned, and you'll notice the same shape of curve, is that the best thing to do to make walking and biking safer is to create more walking and biking. If you double the rate of walking, you decrease your risk of a traffic fatality by 66%. Another important bit of research that hasn't been updated since Donald Appleyard did it in the 1970s is the relationship between how we do transportation and our community health. You'll notice in the top diagram, this is from Donald Appleyard's famous book, Livable Streets. He actually interviewed every household on streets of varying level of traffic, and he found that in a street with a relatively light amount of traffic, still a fair amount of traffic, the people living on that block had 3 friends on that block per person and about 6.3 acquaintances. You increase the traffic, however, on a similarly designed street, and the number of friends drops to 0.9 per person and only 3 acquaintances. And more importantly, when he interviewed people in more detail, the amount of trust on the block with less traffic was extraordinarily high. People would lend their keys to their neighbors, you know, when they were on vacation, take care of their dogs and water their plants and so on. That didn't happen on the block with lots of traffic. We also find increasingly in the medical research that not only is exercise really important for a whole lot of cardiovascular reasons, but green exercise, outdoor exercise, even for short periods of time, is strongly positively correlated with better self-esteem, happier moods, and this is true particularly for young people and for people who are suffering from mental illnesses. Another interesting factor that I am completely fascinated by is a remarkable neuropeptide that our brain produces called oxytocin. This has been in the press a fair amount recently. It is the biological reason for trust and generosity and empathy. It lowers blood pressure, and it increases social behavior such as friendliness. In fact, it's so powerful that it's now being marketed out there on the market where you put this little spray, and I won't show the other images that are associated with it, but you can imagine that this ad is not for oxytocin, but it's a remarkable chemical in that the most powerful way that our body releases it is, of course, during sex, also during breastfeeding, but particularly with human eye contact. Humans are unique among animals in that the contrast between the white, the pupil, and the iris of our eyes is greater than any other species. We get an enormous amount of social information through human eye contact, something that I will point out can only happen on foot, in person, and at 5 kilometers per hour or less. The other way, however, that we release oxytocin in our bodies is through exercise, particularly walking and bicycling. So, if driving, the science tells us, makes us fat, sick, die early, poor, dumb, angry, and mistrustful, and if walking and biking makes us fitter and smarter, able to handle complex reasoning better, the science tells us, sexier, more loving, and more trustful, then why are we still designing our cities around this rather than this? If these were the design vehicle for our transportation system, imagine how much more healthy our cities would be and how much happier all of us would be. So what can you do? Well, the first place to start is to measure success properly, to make sure that everything that you care about in your community is defined clearly in a statement of goals that then follow through to related measurable targets and that have implementable strategies associated with them, and then most importantly, have quantifiable performance measures by which your city officials can judge whether or not they have achieved those goals. If something's just nice and can't be measured, it's going to be ignored. Step 2. Fix your street standards and your street and transportation performance measures. This street, in fact, basically all of your favorite streets in any city that you've ever been to, is likely illegal in that community. It violates every rule of proper street design, and particularly it violates the rules of safe street design. Look at the factors that you love about your favorite streets and make sure that not only are those factors legal, but that your city traffic engineers are required to design streets that you will love walking along. Number 3, rethink traffic mitigation. So one of the things that my industry does, spends a lot of time doing, it's our biggest moneymaker, is analyzing the traffic impact of new development. And we typically analyze the impacts of new development according to a single factor, intersection level of service for motor vehicles, by which we measure the seconds of delay that cars experience at an intersection, not the seconds of delay that people experience at an intersection. So a bus with 40 people on it, those people are valued at 1/40th as relevant as a car with one person in it. Interesting way to look at things. So if you're looking at seconds of delay, the solutions for fixing traffic congestion are to widen roadways, to reduce density, to add parking, or best of all, to move the project to a more isolated rural location where there's not current traffic congestion. Of course, the implication of any of these is to worsen the very problem that we're trying to solve. This is at the root of the unsustainability of all of the practices in my industry, and it needs to change. Step 4, legalize walkable neighborhoods. The city of Vancouver is the best model to follow in all of North America. If your zoning makes it impossible for someone to reasonably walk to get a quart of milk, your zoning is unsustainable. Step 5, get smart about parking. This is an all-day lecture in and of itself, and perhaps the most powerful tool that cities have at their disposal in order to fix some of their sustainability problems and their economic problems in a very, very fast way. So some of the things that we talk to a lot of cities about, eliminating minimum parking requirements. We don't have minimum housing requirements for people. Why do we need minimum housing requirements for cars? Creating park once environments in our business districts where somebody can park their car once and do 6 different things. charging the right price for curb parking to make sure that there are a few parking spaces available on every block, in every parking lot, in every parking garage, to actually not use the Soviet communist method of allocating scarce resources, as we currently do for parking, but not for housing or food, and instead let the market work for us. And finally, manage your parking in order to achieve your city's larger development, congestion management, other goals. And finally, step six, make walking a joyous and delightful part of everyday life. And Brent talked about beauty, Hank talked about joy, and I would talk about delight, because the most important factors of sustainability are these factors that generate love. We know from sustainability science that the most sustainable thing that we can do is to maintain what we already have. And things don't get maintained if they're not lovable. Make your buildings lovable, make your communities lovable, and create cities in which we can all love each other. In order to do that, you all need to be at the table when decisions are made about the built environment and be advocating for that humans matter and that our health, our spiritual, our physical, our mental health all matter in decisions about the built environment, recognizing that the built environment is managed by dozens of different bureaucratic agencies, people in silos who are not talking to each other, people who have over-professionalized their work and have complex formulas designed so that you cannot understand them. You need to understand those formulas. The ones in my profession are really quite easy. What we do is not rocket science. We've got a lot of big words that try to obfuscate and make it seem like it's harder than it is. It's really not. You can all fix the problems in transportation that that create these unsustainable factors. So the other critically important thing to keep in mind is that time is running out, and we need to move beyond platitudes and move beyond general statements about yay sustainability and instead get into the DNA of how our communities are built and funded and how the success of those communities is measured, making sure that human physical, emotional, and spiritual health are factored into those formulas. Rome burned while Nero fiddled, and we have the opportunity to lose an awful lot if we fiddle around with public health in our communities, and yet so very, very much to gain if we understand these factors and get them right. Thank you.
That speech titled Alive Transportation, Fitness, Safety, Community, and Trust was by Jeff Tumlin, a principal at Nelson Nygaard Transportation Planning in beautiful San Francisco. It was recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock on October 7th, 2010 at the Gaining Ground Ecological Conference in Vancouver, Canada. Doomsters rejoice. I found another reason to stock up with food and emergency supplies. The bad news comes from those fringe nuts at NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. In late October, NASA announced a new project trying to protect our electrical grid from violent solar storms. It's called Solar Shield. What else? The good news? NASA thinks they might be able to help prevent long-term damage to the American electric system. The bad news, it isn't working yet and might not prevent a serious hit anyway. How serious? This is where I love reading U.S. government reports that never make the mainstream news. The NASA headline is so catchy, quote, "Did you know a solar flare can make your toilet stop working?" Well, that would be really bad. I don't want the sun to screw up my toilet. It gets worse. It turns out NASA paid for a study by the National Academy of Sciences. That came out in January 2009, titled Severe Space Weather Events, Understanding Societal and Economic Impacts. Buried in those charming 132 pages is hair-raising stuff. 130 million Americans could lose power for months or longer from an event they don't know anything about. When it comes to a big hit, Al-Qaeda is nothing compared to the sun. That's the terrorist. Just think about what a prolonged worldwide blackout means. The National Academy did, and it's ugly. They have charts showing how various layers of society stop functioning in pretty short order. Things like satellites, bank machines, gas pumps, television and radio stations, cash registers, furnaces or air conditioners, and oh yeah, the pumps that deliver water to your taps and your toilet. All that could go down the drain for several months, the experts say. I question whether the whole grid or the economy could ever return again following such an event if it should happen.
Around the world, as electricity stops being generated, the modern world comes to a standstill.
As you considered how many buckets of beans you will need to put away, let's get some background. What is this about? Science writer Dr. Tony Phillips has a couple of great articles about this whole issue on the NASA website. I'll be drawing from his work, and you can find links to it in my EcoShock blog for this program at ecoshock.info. You'll also hear a couple of quick clips from a 2006 Discovery Channel disaster special, The Perfect Disaster, Solar Storm.
The next cycle of extreme solar activity is predicted to happen in 2011.
The existence of solar storms is not a new discovery by any means. Back in 1859, British astronomer Richard Carrington happened to be projecting the sun's image on a white screen to study it. He saw a giant eruption from the surface of our star. About 24 hours later, telegraph lines became electrified, some operators were shocked, and papers in telegraph offices caught fire. Dr. Phillips says the bright night light could be seen from Hawaii to the East Coast. In the Rocky Mountains, campers started to make breakfast in the night, thinking that strange glow was morning. It was called the Carrington Event. Remember that, the Carrington Event, because it was probably at least 50% stronger than the solar storm that hit the Earth in May of 1921, and that's kind of a standard used in this report. A co-author of the National Academy report, John Kappenman of Metatech Corporation, calculated the probable damage today if a 1921-sized superstorm hit us. He found two big areas of, quote, probable power system collapse, the Pacific Northwest and the whole east coast of the United States extending to the Midwest like Ohio and Michigan. Power system collapse is not what you want to hear. The story goes like this. We have enlarged our power system by about 10 times since the 1950s. The U.S. has a gigantic network of power lines, as do many modernized nations of the Earth. These grids act like antennae, attracting the electricity from the solar storm. The more power lines and the more equipment, the denser they are, the more likely they will be hit. It isn't just a matter of knocking out electricity for a few hours. The burst of energy goes for the heavy transformers at the core of our system. These monster transformers, many tons each, with all their copper windings and iron, just melt into useless metal when they get hit. I've seen a photo of a big transformer at an American nuclear power plant melted by one of these solar storms. Nobody can repair them on site. New ones have to be manufactured, transported, and installed. They're big and expensive. Many are custom built. It could take months or years to replace them, if we have enough materials at all. And what would happen during a giant blackout worldwide? The likely social collapse? Our current world production capacity for these big transformers is from 70 to 100 of them a year. Tens of thousands of transformers worldwide are at risk. You do the math. A much smaller flare hit the electrical system in Canada's Quebec province in 1989. A satellite photo shows that whole part of Canada in utter darkness. But the hit was small. They recovered in about 9 hours. A Carrington event, as happened in 1859, Kappenman calculated about 350 big transformers would be killed in the United States alone. That would leave around 130 million people without electricity, likely for months, with, quote, water distribution affected within several hours, perishable foods and medications lost in 12 to 24 hours, loss of heating / air conditioning, sewage disposal, phone service, fuel resupply, and so on, end quote. To quote a bit from NASA writer Tony Phillips, a contemporary repetition of the Carrington event would cause extensive social and economic disruptions, the report warns. Power outages would be accompanied by radio blackouts and satellite malfunctions. Telecommunications, GPS navigation, banking and finance, and transportation would all be affected. Some problems would correct themselves with the fading of the storm. Radio and GPS transmissions could come back online fairly quickly. other problems would be lasting. A burnt-out multi-ton transformer, for instance, can take weeks or months to repair. The total economic impact in the first year alone could reach $2 trillion, some 20 times greater than the costs of a Hurricane Katrina, or to use a timelier example, a few tarps. End quote. And that's just America. The rest of the world could be plunged into darkness as well.
Not just New York, every major city on Earth. It's gonna last for weeks, months, years. No electricity, imagine that. It'd be like winding the clocks back hundreds of years.
On the NASA site, we have a diagram that represents the web of complexity hidden from our view. The caption reads, "A web of interdependencies makes the modern economy especially sensitive to solar storms." Source, Department of Homeland Security. End quote. Experts see arrows of ricocheting damage run from the power system to emergency services, all government functions, from the military to those welfare checks, pensions, payments to workers, that all stops. On the other side, threatened or going down is the whole banking and financial system. No lights, no money, no gas, no phone, no water. For 130 million Americans, possibly for months, the whole world could go into turmoil, with some cities temporarily abandoned, without food or power. The sun has just gone through a decade-long quiet period with hardly any of the sunspots that mark solar storms. Here on Earth, we had less of the northern lights and the southern lights, the impressive colored reflections of solar emissions passing through the upper atmosphere. We don't really know when solar storms will happen. One NASA expert predicts the next storm could hit as soon as 2013. There's already a growing net literature and mythology growing around that year. Mind you, people in both Europe and North America saw a wild aurora borealis light up the night sky on August 3, 2010. In my blog, I've got a link to a Flickr video from NASA of those violent late summer bursts of solar activity this year, vast explosions followed by tentacles of red-hot light reaching far out into space. When these energies pass the Earth, they disturb, distort, and weaken our planet's magnetic field, the same force that points a compass. Normally, this magnetosphere protects the Earth from harmful solar emissions. NASA has learned fairly recently the magnetosphere can be porous. At times, it opens up windows which allow extra solar activity to reach the Earth. These may open from minutes to hours. We are not sure yet. It seems part of the natural system. But a big solar flare, a Carrington event, does not need a window. It crashes right through the walls. I feel unqualified to speak about the actual science of what happens near the ground where we live during one of those events. I may look for a guest to explain this further. My crippled understanding goes like this. The energy is also drawn from the Earth. It's attracted by the solar power, just as lightning sometimes emerges from the ground. This energy, not as much a rebound effect as an attraction event, goes for the power lines and transformers, just as sky lightning goes to church steeples or the tallest tree. I may be wrong about that theory. But the NASA experts certainly say this, the more power connections we make, especially large-scale applications with giant power hubs for our cities, the more likely these systems will be hit and destroyed by a solar storm. More irony for you in a universe full of irony. We expect natural disasters to hit the least developed areas like Haiti or Bangladesh. This one, which Discovery Channel calls the perfect disaster, solar storm, goes for the biggest cities with the biggest power grids. Perfect Disaster was a 2006 TV episode. The show predicts the next period of extreme solar events should arrive in 2011. Nobody knows for sure, and you can watch that video in five parts on YouTube. It might never happen in our lifetime. Solar storm disasters, well, they've been done to death in many science fiction novels and some really bad movies. Is it just disaster porn? So why is NASA announcing the Solar Shield project? They have the SOHO satellite to photograph the sun's surface, to monitor for CME, the dreaded coronal mass ejection that brightened the world, we think, in 1859. Another aging NASA satellite, the ACE, is being set up to measure the solar storm as it goes by, allowing computers to model where the worst impacts will be. All this might give American ground controllers 20 to 30 minutes, we're not sure how long, to shut down the power grid entirely, to isolate the transformers, to make our cities go dark on purpose. Just now, the major power companies are not yet all on board. The decision to shut down American cities would not be easy. Could it happen at all in time if the Solar Shield project goes ahead? Don't forget, a solar storm is a global event. Every major city could go dark from Australia through Asia, through the Middle East, through Europe, through North America, South America, China, all of it. Developing countries could take a decade or more to get the power back up as world transformer production goes to the highest bidder or to military might. Satellites carrying the entire global communication and financial system may be struck dead. None of this is science fiction. It is science, reality on a small planet near an irregular sun. It's just one more way our overcomplex civilization could crash. Just one more reason why I do have a year's worth of food stored away, why I live near a river, why I know how to grow things, why I question any future that cannot accomplish localization, solar power on every house, decentralization, simplification, frugality, self-sufficiency.
We need to shut down. Just do it.
Roberto Vaca called the crash of complexity the coming dark age. That was back in 1973, and he was wrong then. Now the book is online and updated. Roberto Vaca is waiting. Can we prove him wrong? On Radio EcoShock, we'll continue the exploration of complexity and our utter dependence on fossil power from those past ages. Can we save the climate without a giant economic crash, without a tech blackout or a population crash, without a time of horror? Are we living in a deadly fantasy? Some trust the nightmare will turn into a benign dream after all, and it may. Others fear to wake up. I'm Alex Smith. That's about as much of Telstar as I can stand. The excitement when that instrumental by the British band The Tornadoes, well, it was huge in 1962. People were caught up in the new space age, and this song was named after one of the early commercial communication satellites, Telstar, owned by AT&T. The other odd noises you heard came from a project I believe was called Cosmos with a K. Now I've lost track of who did it. Some scientists found rhythms in the waves coming from various distant stars. They hooked up synthesizers and let the stars play their own music according to the frequency received. If you know who did it, please drop me an email, radio@ecoshock.org. The music of the universe, indeed. Many thanks to Radio EcoShock listeners for their guest suggestions. Caleb in New England pointed me to Rebecca, who he'd just heard at the Harvard Coop. And Guy in Australia, so many thanks to you. Next week, I'll be talking with Julian Cribb about the coming global famine for an upcoming interview. Keep up your tips, boys and girls, as Radio EcoShock sets out to rule the world.
Actually, we are two laboratory mice who wish to be on your show as part of an intricate plan to take over the world.
And welcome to our 23rd station, and all you Canucks listening on CJUM College Radio in Winnipeg, Canada. We're all in for a wild and bumpy ride. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
The chains listen to the voices, sinking chains. We must stop doing.